to the Copy Blogger Podcast. My name is Tim Stoddart. I am once again joined by Ethan. I hope everybody had a great week. What's up, Ethan? How are you?
I'm doing good, man. Happy Friday. How you doing?
I'm great. Oh, man. I forgot to tell you. I'll actually have to send you the video. When you lived in Denver, I don't know if you experienced anything like this, but we got a hailstorm yesterday. That was one of the most insane experiences of my entire life. And apparently it's more common to get hail in Denver just because of the barometric pressure. I don't know if anybody knows how hail actually becomes a thing, but it's really, really interesting because it's summer and it was super hot yesterday and there was ice falling from the sky the size of golf balls. I'll send you a video. Wait until you see this. It was one of the most wild experiences I've ever had in my life.
That's pretty cool, man. Yeah, I didn't actually realize that happened in Denver too. When I spent a very short period of time in Colorado, but I was living just behind the front range of the Rockies. And so we would get the craziest weather and you could see it coming from like 20 miles away. It's all plateau up there, but same thing, heat and then rain and then snow and then heat again and then freezing cold all in the same day. It's just wild.
It was pretty wild for sure. So I'll send you that video. Anybody listening to this in Denver, I hope your cars are okay. I hope you're okay. Send me your videos. It was wild. Okay, let's get into this one. I am more excited about this episode than any episode that we've recorded. I'm going to tee that up as a little bit of a cliffhanger because first I want to shout out Lara Acosta. I really, really hope I got the first name right. It may be Lara, L-A-R-A, last name Acosta, A-C-O-S-T-A. She is killing it on LinkedIn. And I've been just following her for a while. And she followed me back. And I saw it. I was like, oh, man, that is so cool. And so I sent her a DM. And she immediately started giving praises to the Copy Blogger, excuse me, obviously, to our podcast. I'm looking at the website right now, which is why I like spoke about ourselves in the third person. But she's like, yeah, every time I do cardio, you guys are in my ears during cardio day. And again, we really, really appreciate that. So Lara, again, excuse me if I got that wrong, but check her out on LinkedIn. She's totally killing it.
That's awesome. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Lara. That's awesome. I actually wasn't going to shout anybody out because I hadn't thought about this before the show, but you're reminding me that like literally right before coming in to record here, I had a great conversation with this guy named Chook. That's a shortened name, but he goes by Chook, which is C-H-U-K. He is a community builder in Austin, and he listened to a couple of our podcasts, but specifically the one that we did about Hampton launching.
Oh.
And such a cool guy. Just wanted to say, Chook, thanks for listening, man. And if you guys are in Austin, just like, I guess, probably just Google his name. He hosts a whole bunch of events around there and you'll definitely find him.
Amazing. And check out both of these people in the show notes. We'll link out to their profiles if you want to follow along. All right, let's get into it.
Yeah.
Last night I texted you and I said, hey, let's do a show about Peter Zeihan. Peter Zeihan is more of like one of these underground sleeper creators that is huge, but not a lot of people in our ecosystem probably know who he is. And you immediately said, whoa, Tim, get out of my brain. I was thinking the exact same thing. I've been doing a little bit of a write-up on him. You and I have spoken about him a few times on the pod, I think. I think that you and I are interested in the relationships of countries and geopolitics. Not that this is a political show by any means, but it's going to be the framework as to what Peter Zeihan talks about as well. But more than that, he does so many things that are so unique and so uniquely him. And man, I've been really inspired by what he does, and I'm so excited to talk about it. So I'm pumped about this. I don't even know where to start. Help me out here.
Same. Yeah, no, I got a great question I want to ask you in a second, but I will just confirm for a second that that is exactly what happened. And just another great example of how, for some reason, you and I like end up on the same wavelength without even meaning to. That was hilarious that you texted me that. We're going to get into why Peter is such an interesting creator. He's somebody who's been on my radar for a long time, and he's somebody that I've been breaking down recently. But before we get into his business as a creator, I want to say one thing, and then I want you to set one thing up for people. So for the people who do know who he is, Peter is a controversial character because he focuses on geopolitics. So, you know, if you're on his side, you're going to love him. If you don't agree with a lot of what he says, you're going to hate him. I think for the bulk of this show, we're going to stay outside of the politics for the most part and just explore who he is as like a creator and a personality. Because whether you like his politics or you don't like him, there's a lot you can learn from him. So stick with us, even if you find him controversial. And then sort of the second part of that is, can you set up for people just a little bit more about what he does, like what he's known for among the people who do know him, and why he kind of captured your attention in the first place, aside from his work as a creator?
I would be really happy to. So he considers himself a geopolitical strategist. And we throw the word geopolitics around a lot without actually giving a whole bunch of understanding as to what that means. So geo is short for geography. And it turns out that the more and more I've listened to him, I'm convinced that like the most determining factor as to how society plays out for your culture is based on the geography about where you live. There's just certain things that you can't get around when you live in different places of the world, and how mountain ranges and rivers and access to oceans and the fertility of soil and access to oil and anything you can think of, like even how far away different places are in relationship to each other and how they have to share resources. It creates this whole wild interconnected web of advantages and disadvantages, the different cultures, and we can call them countries, but it's not so much countries because countries move. I would just let's call them cultures for the sake of this conversation, right? How they interact with each other. I've always been interested in history. One of my favorite subjects to read about is history and wars and World War I, especially. It's just something I've always been into, right? And his book came on my radar. It's called The End of the World is Just the Beginning. And basically, I'm not going to explain the whole book, but the main concept behind it is that globalism and the interconnectedness of all cultures in the world is plummeting, is getting smaller and smaller. And everybody can see that, especially if you're in America. Like we're less and less interested in being the police of the world. And that has like effects that you wouldn't necessarily think of. So I enjoyed his book. I found a couple of his videos. He's got some really, really, as you said, controversial ideas. But now that I've teed up who he is and how we study or what he studies, I think we can easily transition into like how he has made such a big name for himself recently, because it's really cool. Like seriously, he's super unique, and I just dig his whole process and even his style.
Definitely. Yeah, that's one of the things that stood out to me too, which I think we'll get into in a bit, but you hit the nail on the head. Style. His delivery is different than most people who would typically cover this topic, which is definitely one of the things that's making him successful. And I think there's a lesson there no matter what you talk about as your topic for like a creator or writer. So as we dig into this, I want to create like a framework for what the shape of the episode is going to be as well, because I think there are a few key lessons that you can really learn from breaking down any creator. We're going to apply them to Peter in this show, but really, if you're listening to this, one of the big takeaways is like, hey, here's a great way to just deconstruct what somebody else is doing in order to learn from them. So before we dive any deeper, I'm going to just give a little bit more background on who he is. I'm going to actually provide a counterbalance too. So people who are listening to this, who already know him and they're like, dude, this guy's full of shit. I can't stand Peter. These guys are morons for believing him. I will acknowledge that stance is out there, and I'm going to present the counter argument as well. And what we're going to do, well, I'll get into that in a second. So we'll present a little counterbalance just so that you know, this isn't just the Peter Zion fan club show. I'll give a little bit of background as to why I still think it's a good idea not to write him off, because as you've mentioned, he has some pretty interesting and unique background qualities that make him especially qualified as a creator. So we'll get into that. We'll get into the business model. How does this guy actually make money doing what he's doing? Which I think is it's a slight variation on something that we've talked about on this show multiple times. So it'd be really cool to see that applied. And then I would love to talk just a little bit about like how he's growing and what his publication stuff looks like. Because to me, the reason that I nerd out on his work is the research process behind it. I'm so curious about how he does that. And I've gotten, this is something that I'm still kind of uncovering, but the processes that professionals use to really sort of develop ideas and then share them with the world is something that I'm passionate about. So we'll talk a little bit about that too. So real quick, let's give some counterbalance to this. Here's what we're going to do in the show notes. I'm going to link to two podcast episodes. One is an interview with Peter that he did on The Motley Fool. It's about 30 minutes long, and it's a great introduction to who he is if you don't know him already, because he basically hits the high points of all his main points and delivers them in a way that's in line with like what Tim and I are calling out here, like why he's so unique. You'll get a good taste for who he is. I'm also going to link to a guy who wrote and recorded this episode saying, I think it's just titled like Peter Zion is the Jim Cramer of geopolitics. And if you don't know who Jim Cramer is, he's like a stock picker TV personality, notorious for being wrong. I've never verified this myself, but there's something called like the anti-Cramer index, which basically just does the opposite of whatever he calls out. And it's up, I don't know, like tremendously or something like that. So this person was very critical of Peter's work. And we'll link off to both of them so you can hear both sides. And then I'll probably link to a third episode as well that is a good middle ground. It's a person who admires the work that Peter Zion and other people kind of in his camp do, but is also critical of kind of a blind spot that he feels like they have. So we'll link to some resources in the show that'll give you like a more big or like full picture view of what people's opinion is on his work. That said, I think Tim and I are both fans, so that's obviously the bias that we bring to the table here. That being said, let's get a little bit closer into like who this guy is and why it might be unwise to write him off. So you mentioned that he has a book, The End of the World is Just the Beginning. It's one of four books that he's published so far. He's been publishing books as far back as 2014, and they've all sort of revolved around this exact same theme. A little bit more background on him is that ever since 2014, he's also been publishing a newsletter that's almost daily and a blog, and he basically uses those to promote his books and promote other products that are kind of in line with that. So a couple of times a week, publish a short piece about what's going on in the world and like what the repercussions are geopolitically or what the causes of that are geopolitically. Prior to that, he spent more than a decade as a geopolitical analyst at a company called Stratfor, which is sort of short for strategic forecasting, I think. And it was basically this private research group that was based in Austin. And have you heard of these guys? Did this come up in your research at all?
No, but I knew that he lived in Austin, so that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. I had never heard of them, but I think it might have just been like our generation was one step behind the news. So Stratfor was basically like the shadowy branch of the CIA. And for a long time, they were kind of unknown. And then they came into the public spotlight after a few like very public controversies. But this is basically a consulting group. And they had an information network that was global in reach. And they used to consult with groups like the U.S. Homeland Security, U.S. Marine Corps, Department of Defense, and then other groups like Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, major companies like Coca-Cola. What these groups do is they basically are in charge of developing information systems so that allow them to tap into things that are going on the ground all over the world and analyze risk across a few different domains. So they'll look at things like personal safety risk, right? Like an example of that would be, where are wars about to break out? Where is the physical security of people not very high? You could imagine why that would be interesting or important for governments to know, but it would also be important for like multinational companies to know, because they have employees in these countries or their supply chains rely on these countries. That's another area of risk as well, supply chain risk that they look at. And then they'll also look at things like legal risk. So where are laws changing that may affect how a company does business or something like that? And so Zion did this for more than a decade. He was there and eventually left in 2012 to start his own company. And ever since then, he's been working solo, publishing books. And then he basically makes money through his consulting work. So he'll do speaking for these major companies, or he'll do like executive briefs for these companies. We'll get into the business model in a little bit more depth later. But I wanted to just give that as a little bit of background, because I think it would be easy to look at this person on YouTube who's just out there saying things and kind of... And this is where I feel that the criticism, specifically the podcast that I'm going to share in the show notes, maybe underestimated some of his qualifications, right? Because we as creators, we're so used to seeing people who are out here just kind of winging it, right?
Saying things, yeah.
Yeah, they're Googling stuff, or they're looking at the news and they're just giving an opinion or something like that. But there is such a thing in this industry as people who are not playing with the same cards as everybody else. And when you look into the history of Stratfor, it's a perfect example. I mean, this was a private spy company. In fact, I dug into them a little bit deeper. You're going to love this. So the reason they came into the national kind of spotlight was that WikiLeaks leaked like 5 million emails from this company that showed everything about how it worked and like how they paid people off, how they got information. I might even have a quote here real quick, let me see if I can find it. And we'll link to this in the show notes too, so you can still find all the files, they're publicly available. But it basically says, WikiLeaks is publishing the global intelligence files, more than 5 million emails from the Texas headquartered global intelligence company Stratfor. The emails date from 2004 to 2011. They reveal the inner workings of a company that fronts as an intelligence publisher, but provides confidential intelligence services to large corporations and government agencies. They show that Stratfor's web of informers, payoff structure, payment laundering techniques, and psychological methods. For example, this is a quote. Quote, you have to take control of him. Control means financial, sexual, or psychological control. This is intended to start our conversation on your next phase. That's a quote from the CEO, George Friedman, to Stratfor analyst Riva Bala on December 6th of 2011 on how to exploit an Israeli intelligence informant providing information on the medical condition of the president of Venezuela. So this group is playing with a different set of information than most like armchair YouTube analysts, right? Yeah. That's the world that he was steeped in. That's the world that he came from. Now, the last thing I'll just say about that is like, it obviously didn't work out great for them. They got blown up, super controversial, and were eventually purchased by some company in New York. So like Stratfor itself is, I believe, sort of a shadow of what it formerly was. So, you know, don't do that. But the reality is, for a long time, he was an analyst in an incredibly tapped in spy network, essentially a private spy network. And that, I think, puts him on a slightly different standing than most YouTube voices. Let's just say that.
Oh, that's crazy. So clearly, he has built up a credibility, which, like I said, I think makes it easy for him to be taken seriously. And we wanted, I know that for those listening, it might have been a little arduous to go through all of that, but we wanted to really, really drive home the point that when you're making stuff, it actually does matter that A, you know what you're talking about, and that B, you're like skilled. You're a skilled craftsman. You're a skilled artist in any definition of the word is, because there really is such a thing as being good at what you do. It's not so easy as, hey, just start making things and somebody will like it and somebody will share it. and you'll just get rich. He's been involved for a long time in the world that he reports on. And so with that, I want to breathe some fresh air into this a bit and talk about how he is actually succeeding online. And this is something about him that I find absolutely insane. So I'm going to share my screen. Anybody who's watching the video, you'll be able to see it, obviously. So I want to do some math here. So this is his YouTube channel. All he does, and I'm not saying this to diminish the work because it doesn't seem like work, but we just spent half the episode talking about how inundated in this world he is and how much he's built up all of this credibility. But so check this out. He publishes basically 5 videos a week, Monday through Friday, and he sends it out through his newsletter. And I don't even know how we can do this, but this video is 5 minutes and 52 seconds. He grabs his cell phone every morning, basically goes into his backyard or wherever the hell he is in the world, because he's always traveling to random countries, records at most a 15-minute video. And that's very rare. I'd say the average time is probably 6 minutes. They're hardly edited. I get the impression that he records a video on his phone, uploads it to Dropbox. Somebody does a once over edit and then puts a featured image on it and uploads it onto his YouTube channel. So I'm going to say all in all, it's about on average 15 minutes a day of his work. And now look at this. 127,000 views, 425,000 views, 328,000 views, 515, 617, 401. It's bonkers the amount of, like, he might be the most successful YouTuber in the world right now if you take that definition of hours recorded in comparison to views gotten, right? Like, this video is 12 minutes long. He recorded it on his cell phone in front of his school because he was visiting his family in, I think, Iowa or whatever. He just grabs his cell phone, records his take, and uploads it onto YouTube every day. And he's averaging, I don't know, 3 times 5, 1.5 million views a week, right? Like, how much money is that in ad revenue? I bet he's making more money on YouTube revenue than he is on his consulting firm at this point. It's absolutely insane how he figured out. The reason why he inspires me is just because he doesn't take it too seriously. And I really, really mean that. I struggle with publishing stuff and feeling like it's not published, polished enough, or like it doesn't live up to, you know, these other expectations that I've set and compared to what other people that I might be competing against have done. He plays by his own rules totally. He just says, yeah, I'm going to record a video on my phone every day, and then I'm going to send it out to my email list, and I'm going to be, might arguably, the most successful YouTuber in the world right now that nobody knows about. I just think that is so cool, and it makes me want to not take myself so seriously as well.
Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely something about this that I find inspiring. It's like similar, which is like, it feels like, you know how there's this kind of fantasy among creators that like, you're going to build an audience and then I'll finally just have my days to think and write, you know? Yeah. Or like, I'm going to think and I'm going to read and then I'm going to share ideas. It really feels like that's what he does. And I keep trying to dig deeper into how his operations, because I know it's got to be more complex than that. But if you look at the timestamp on that video screen that you were just looking at, it was shared 9 hours ago. We're recording this at about 4 p.m. Eastern. And so that means, you know, let's just call it, what would that be? 5 hours before noon. What is 5 hours before noon? 7 a.m.?
Yeah.
So by 7 a.m., the video is live, but it's live and he's talking about today's news, which yeah. means somehow he gets up in the morning. Here's what I'm betting it is. I think it's like this. Gets up in the morning, has some kind of, you know, diet of information. You scroll through super fast and pick out what the topic of the day is. Then he's almost always recording on a hike. So you get out for the morning hike. That's where he records, right? And then you maybe uploads to Dropbox while you're finishing the hike or something like that. By the time he gets home, the jump cuts have been done. The video is ready to go out. So you write up the newsletter real quick and you send it out for the day. That kind of seems to me like what the process is. But I admire that. As somebody who would like much rather spend my time out kind of hiking and thinking about the things that I'm seeing and reading or consuming rather than, I don't know, managing like little details of a business. I think he's got a very interesting setup so far. So that's what I've been working to deconstruct. But I also think there's another lesson there for you, which you tapped on as well. It's for other creators, which is like, don't take it so seriously, right? So one of the things that's so compelling about him is not just that he has a counter narrative, but he's like hilarious in the way that he shares it. I always say he's kind of like a coyote trickster, you know? Yeah. So, and this may be the one redeeming quality for non-US listeners, right? Because Zion is like able to poke fun at the US just as much as he is anybody else. He's extremely critical of like both government factions. It's like, he's like a man with no country, you know? And I think there's something to that, which is like, I think it ties into what you said. Don't take it so seriously. You know, you have to be able to make fun of your own expertise and your own opinions as a creator.
Totally. So there's almost a juxtaposition between him and I'd say like a Ben Shapiro, right? Somebody that sort of plays in the same exact space and has the whole YouTube studio set up. All of the edits are probably checked over and then checked over again and checked over again, just so their point is so articulately laid out. And how do I say it? I don't watch a whole lot of Ben Shapiro. I don't watch a whole lot of people on the other side either, because I get the feeling that when they make those videos, there's so much work is being put into the framing of the opinion. You know, there's like the creation of it. And then it's almost like all the time it takes to storyboard it out. You know, like you have to say in exactly this order so that the crescendo of the message like delivers our point home and everybody else is stupid and we're better. And that makes me uncomfortable. It makes a lot of people uncomfortable. And then you have this guy who goes out for hikes in the morning. Sometimes he's wearing this like purple jester hat that is exactly as ridiculous as it sounds, is winded because he's like up a hill. He's like breathing heavy and talking about these ridiculous data points about how, you know, particular pipelines need to navigate through certain geographical intersections and why that's having an impact on the food prices in France. Right. And then you think about it, it's like, oh, yeah, like clearly that's going to have these secondary effects that are going to make people think and feel that the way that they are. And so there's not all of this work in like, it's not just making it perfect. It's making it unarguable-ish. Right. Like, this is my point. I'm on this side. I'm driving this point home. And there's this dude that's getting more views than all of them in a daily YouTube video on his phone with a jester hat on. And there's something about that that it's charming. Yeah. But it also, it just reminds me that if you know what you're talking about, you can do whatever you want. You know, there really just is a thing to being better than other people. And well, I think that's cool.
There's a part of that too. That's like, no, that's, dealing in the truth. So if you're dealing in the truth, you're never always going to be right. And you're always never going to be 100% right. And like, that's something that I think gets lost, especially on the political spectrum of entertainment. You were talking about it a second ago. It gets old, man. Like I enjoyed people like, I mean, I still enjoy people like Ben Shapiro or who's the young woman, Brett something. She runs the comments section. It's Brett something, but they're great. Right. I enjoy them. I enjoy anybody who will bring like a breath of fresh air, a counter argument to the table. It could be either side, right? It's just got to be somebody who's looking at something that doesn't make sense and then like bringing a fresh perspective to it. And so as somebody who kind of sits in the middle, I can find that on both sides, right? But it gets old when that same person becomes incapable or like inflexible in their ideas or incapable of admitting where their own ideas have a shortcoming, which all of them will. Everybody is going to have something wrong. And so like one thing that is kind of like refreshing, well, actually, I'll leave Peter aside for a second, but what you're saying reminds me of that need as a creator is to kind of never take yourself too seriously. It's funny that this came up. I didn't actually expect this to come up, but I was just thinking this the other day. I was thinking, you know how Ryan Holiday made those Memento Mori coins? For people who don't know, Ryan Holiday, obviously, most people know Ryan Holiday, but you might not know that like one of his most successful products isn't necessarily a book. It's this like challenge coin that's got a skull stamped into it. And the idea is that you carry it around and it's a reminder that you will one day die. So don't take life too seriously, right? Or do the important things. What I was thinking to myself is like, we really need that message, but we need another message too, which is like, you're never more than half right, or you're always half a fool in whatever your opinions are. Yeah. And so I was thinking, you're hearing it here first. If anybody is more motivated than me, feel free to go out and make this happen. But I want to create a challenge coin, or I want somebody to create a challenge coin that's like half skull with the jester cap on. And then, oh, what was the other part? I forget. There's other symbolism built into it. But the whole idea is like, you're going to die and you're probably wrong about half the things you believe. So don't take it too seriously. I feel like I see a Tim thought settling in.
This is so random. And I don't even know if this is going to come out in the way I intend it. But there's a YouTube channel that I subscribe to that comes on sometimes. It's called Charisma on Demand. And it's a great channel, actually. I really love it. They take like movie characters and actors and stuff and real people and characters, people that have been universally decided upon to have charisma, right? Whatever the hell that means. And they did one on Tom Hardy. And one of the things that they said about him was that he doesn't act in a way that makes it so like he wants you to like him. He's acting in a way where you're deciding if he likes you. And as soon as I saw that, it made me think of the today's podcast episode, because that's Peter Zion kind of has that thing about him where he's not necessarily trying to make it so that you like him. You get this kind of impression that like he's deciding whether he likes you. And it's a weird flip on it. And it's, you know, I don't know the guy by any means. It's just this approach that he takes to it, where everybody else, they're formulating these arguments and they're creating these like entertainment channels where it's like, I'm right and you need to like me. And if you don't like me, it doesn't matter because I'm still right. Like they're forcing the viewpoint that they want their audience to have about them out there. You know, like they're projecting their most desired appearance, where he's kind of the opposite way. Like he's actually not trying to make you like him. You get the feeling that in his head, he's always contemplating as to whether somebody else is full of shit or not. And I hope I explained that well. It was the first thought that came into my head when I watched this Charisma on Demand video. I was walking on the treadmill this morning, just getting loose at the gym. And I just, you know, popped on that YouTube video. And as soon as I saw that, the first thing I thought about was like, oh, wow, that's such a cool analogy for today's podcast. And I don't know how to teach somebody how to do that, but it's pretty cool.
That's a really interesting call out. I want to mention one or two other things that I think he does well that other creators would learn from that specifically help with his business model. So we haven't really broken this down in detail yet, but here's how he makes money. By the way, for anybody who's new listening to the show, this is a model that Tim and I talk about in a lot. If you want the deep breakdown, look up our episode. That's like how to get to 10,000. Oh, geez. What was the, how to build a $10,000 a month business fast? Yeah. Or
I think so. It was one of the first episodes that we've ever done.
Oh my God. Well, I guess we're going to have to link it in the show notes, but look in the show notes. We'll link to it. Anyways, the model is pretty simple. This is the model that virtually all media companies are built on. You have free products, front-end products, and back-end products. Your free products are monetized via ads. They're always your biggest audience because they're free. It's the lowest barrier to entry. And they are used as distribution to sell your front and back-end products. The difference between front and back-end products is front-end products are usually a little bit more broad and they're priced a little bit lower. Back-end products are much more specific and they're priced much, much higher. So for media, typically front-end would be like $50 to $100 a year. Back-end is like $500 up and it can go way up into the thousands and thousands of dollars per year. Okay, so that's the model. As you would expect, Zion's business fits perfectly inside of it. So here's basically what he's got. He's got a free newsletter, right? That's his main distribution. And then he's got Twitter and YouTube channels. And both of those promote the newsletter directly. So he's out there on social media, growing his newsletter audience via Twitter, via YouTube. And then also he does like a lot of interviews. So you can find him on other podcasts as well. The newsletter, as far as I can tell, doesn't monetize with ads. It's always free. And he actually makes a very big point of saying it's free. It's always going to be free, which is great. We talked about this in our two episodes ago as well. If you have a newsletter that is free, make it very clear that it's free because people don't always realize that they can sign up for free. But I've gone through a whole bunch of different issues. I'm not the structure is usually the same. It's a quick shout out before linking off to the video of the day. And then usually there's some information about a charity that he's donating money to. And then there'll be some links to buy his books or webinars. And then that brings us into front and back end products. So for the front end, remember that's low cost, right? He's got a series of four books that he's getting royalties from. And then on the back end, that's 500 and up, he's got a series of webinars that he'll do on specific topics, like how to deal with inflation. So he's got, as I found, five of them so far. They tend to be about $650 to $750 for access. And then he's got even more expensive. He'll have consulting and speaking, or speaking and consulting. It's probably, the prices probably go up in that order. Now, here's where the really smart thing is that I think all creators can learn from. And I realized this yesterday while I was listening to an interview with him. What he has done a really good, interesting job of is taking something that he's obsessed with and finding a way to make it relevant to clients that will pay a lot of money to figure out what you think about it. So the obsession started early. If you listen to, I just finished listening to his book, The Accidental Superpower, which I think was his first one. He talks about how as a kid, he was always obsessed with maps. Like even as a baby, he was obsessed with maps. And that's where this interest in geopolitics first got its root. It's this obsession with how the world is shaped and how that changes us and what's over the next horizon and all that stuff. Okay, great. Now you could be obsessed with maps and be broke your entire life. So what Peter has done is found a way to take that information and package it up in such a way that electronics manufacturers, agricultural giants, and energy giants and governments are willing to pay for it, right? So those are kind of like the three or four big groups that he talks to. And when I noticed that, the thing in my head was just, that's such a good takeaway. Take whatever you're interested in and figure out how do I show that this is relevant to a group that's got a really big interest in, or a group that's got a lot of money and would benefit from knowing more about this. So I'll give a very specific example. In that last book, he's talking, he was written back in 2014, and he's talking about the shale revolution. Now, most of us as consumers, when I think shale, I think fracking, I think dirty oil, right? What's interesting about the book, and I've never fact checked this, so somebody who's listening could fact check it, but he basically says, actually, there's never been a single EPA water violation against a fracking well. This is, again, back in 2014. So apparently, I'm going to get this slightly wrong, but it's like he was making the case that this is actually a very clean technology. But for the oil executives who want to expand into this, they need to find a way to communicate that to a broader audience, right? So the takeaway there is like, oh, he was talking about this particular technology that he finds has a very interesting effect, but then he connected it to a super high-end audience. energy producers and said, hey, by the way, if you're interested in making more money off this, you're going to need to know how to position it so that this audience will buy in and I can show you how to do that, right? That might come across as sleazy, but the reality is, like, if you listen to the book, he's pushing them to basically invest more in making it cleaner and getting it over the line to make sure that it was like it wasn't ruining water and stuff like that. So not only did he find a way to put to package up the research for a high paying audience, but as somebody who's pretty eco-friendly, he also used that platform to push these major companies to realize that they could, like, actually benefit from cleaning up this technology as well, right? So all these are just great lessons for other creators too. Take your topic, figure out who are the massive players with huge budgets that need to know about this, and how can I show them the imperative of knowing about this? And then potentially, if you're interested in some kind of social change, I think you get a lot farther by convincing people that they're going to benefit from social change rather than, like, just trying to shut down oil companies or whatever, right?
I actually think this is the most important lesson of this whole episode. It's great that he's killing it on YouTube. It's great that he spent all of this time researching his craft and being skilled. It's great that he's followed this model. But I think this is the most important formula in business. And I guess I'll give a personal example. While you were talking, I was trying to think of something that didn't have to do with me. So it's not all about me, but I didn't come up with anything, right? My whole life, I wanted to be a writer. And I was always taught that if you wanted to be a writer, that meant that you had to write books. And accidentally, I can't take any personal credit for this, I did the same exact thing. I've always been obsessed with writing. And then at some point in my life, I got obsessed with, like, health and wellness and recovery and all of those things, right? And the connection between the two presented this unique and not easily visualized opportunity that only I was in that particular position to see. And now, like, I am a writer. I didn't necessarily go into my writing career thinking that, like, I was going to be a high-level content producer for a dry and boring healthcare industry. But that's not actually the point. The point is that if you go into your creative career, your entrepreneurial career, thinking that the you that you want to become has, like, a very, very specific path, a straight line, you're really, really selling yourself short, because the opportunity is in the presentation of how your one combination of obsessions and skill sets can be applied to something that is so much bigger than the typical career definition, right? Like, you're a writer, you're a map maker, you're a designer. Oh, okay, cool. Well, I'm not actually, like, I'm a high level SEO for super, super big healthcare conglomerates. He's not necessarily a map maker. He's, like, a super, super high level consultant for energy, agriculture, and electronics companies that have to find workarounds for the natural geography of the world. So it's a hard thing to make an ebook out of, you know, like, it's not the kind of thing that you can say, here, follow this perfect little framework. You can download it on my website for free. Like, all you got to do is sign up. It's not that kind of thing. It takes visualization and a little outside of the box thinking, but that really, 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 really is the way to level up yourself, where you're not just another creator making stuff that everybody else is making. You've found the certain combination of your obsessions and skills and unique experiences, and you've found an application that somebody is willing to pay so much more money for than they would if they were just, you know, downloading a $9 ebook from your website.
That's a great way of putting it. And we've said this on the show as well before, like there is no objective value of information, right? Yeah. It really depends on how you're packaging things and who you're approaching with it. And he does provide a great lesson in that. And, you know, I think I'll leave it at that. I don't want to belabor the point. Okay. So main takeaways so far for me were like, first of all, the model is still universal. Still haven't found somebody who's breaking that yet. Make sure if you want to make money, think about who the high-end audiences are that have a stake in knowing what it is you have to say.
Yes, totally. So well said.
And then deliver consistently and don't take it too seriously.
Yeah, and the don't take it too seriously is one that I am going to try. I think we do a pretty good job of that with this show, but there's also an element of where you try so hard to fit this mold of what you think it's supposed to be, you end up blending in via professionalism, right? And there's a way to stand out. It's not just like, don't pay attention to it, don't try that hard, whatever's going to happen. It's not about that. I'm not trying to let anybody off the hook. You know, I'm not trying to say, you don't have to really care about it. Just be yourself, be authentic, right? That's terrible fucking advice. Nobody wants the authentic you. They want the you that they expect to show up every day. But it's a combination of allowing yourself to be the you that only you are with just consistency. And he does that really well. And that's something that I'm trying to get better at.
How are you getting better at that?
Well, I've talked about it before, but seriously, those thumbnail images on my blog were like a huge, huge step for me. Every single time I publish one of those things, every time. I love these images. These images are so great. You know, with video, this could be a whole nother podcast topic within itself, but I've been thinking a lot about podcasts and about video and about like vlogging, because I'm having a hard time. I think vlogging is so unique to the person that it's probably a little more AI proof than some of the other things that we're going to see disruptions of. And I was thinking about how I can do that without taking it too seriously, without feeling like I need all the boom mics and the lighting to be perfect, or it's just, this is my day and this is what I'm doing. And these are the experiences that I learned, but really I don't think I'm doing a very good job, but I think that's also a curse of writers, you know, because you can write a 3,000 word essay and you have one grammar mistake in it and you get 100 email replies saying like, oh, by the way, you made a mistake here. And by the way, none of these people have ever said anything nice about like all of the work that you've done, but you make one grammar mistake. So mistakes in writing, they stick out a little bit more than mistakes in audio or video, but nonetheless, it's, I don't have a good answer. Like I don't think I'm doing it very well, and I want to be better at it just so I can project my most authentic self.
I'm surprised to hear you say that, because I feel like of the two of us, you actually are the better at that. And I would also say, one benefit of embracing like authenticity as a public figure is that your audience becomes a little bit more forgiving of those mistakes as well. Like, if you want to be the person who's perfect, good luck maintaining that. Have you seen, what's his name? Who's the comedian who went through like rehab recently and just came out with a new special?
Oh, yeah, of course. He wears the suit and tie.
Suits.
I watched it. It was so funny.
It was really good.
Yeah.
God, this is the worst. He's super famous. Anyways. Whatever his name is.
That was a funny part about his bit where he talked about, oh, I'm going to go into rehab and everybody's going to recognize me. And nobody recognized him.
Yeah. But that whole, I mean, his whole recent special was really about how that fall from grace has freed him to be more authentic and more himself. And I loved it. I thought, I mean, I've always liked his comedy, but I thought this one was better than everything that's come before it. So, and, you know, I see Sam Parr is one of the ones that I look up to in this. Like, he's very authentically himself. And that doesn't just get him a lot of like love from his audience. It also, there's like a tactical benefit too, which is that for Sam to ship something, it doesn't take much time, because it's like, you know, 80% of what he ships can be shipped almost immediately, because Everybody who pays attention to him is, I guess, used to getting off the cuff thoughts, right? So there's a famous example, his course. People who watch My First Million, you're probably familiar with the Copy That course. I was there when he made that up. We were literally on a Zoom call, and somebody on the call had said, I'm struggling to launch this product because it's really hard to test the idea. And so just to kind of like offer some encouragement, he literally tweeted immediately, I'm going to create this course. He put up a Gumroad page and he tweeted about it and just immediately tested it to show like, this is how you do it. This is how you get out of your own way. And that's become a multi six figure product. So there's something to be said for authenticity and this whole concept of just taking everything down a notch most of the time, or some of the time. I don't know what the right ratio is. But yeah, those are the big lessons. I think you're smart to invest in constantly improving your ability to show up authentically, because it's not easy. Yeah. And I was glad that we did this, man. I feel like I learned a lot from Peter's work, and I hope people liked this. So you can let us know what you think if you want us to do more like creator breakdowns or something like that. Speaking of, can I do one more creator shout out since now we're starting to close the shows with creator shout outs?
Of course. Yeah, wrap it up.
All right. I told you a few weeks ago that like I have this sort of budding obsession with woodworking. I don't know why. I think actually I do know why. It's because it's like so old. You know, I really like things that aren't so reliant on new technology. I find them very calming these days. So anyways, I've been watching a ton of woodworking videos on YouTube, and I stumbled across this guy. His name is Ari Itkin, and his YouTube channel is Slow Woodshop. It's pretty new. I think he's only got like 8 videos out there right now. But what I really liked about it is that he just started this series. And I think we made this prediction about the Reddit method guy. I'm going to make another prediction. I think this is going to be Ari's path to a large audience. What he's doing right now, he's done a couple of different videos, but the last two have consistently been the same theme, which is that he picks somebody who's well-known and then designs a really nice woodworking gift for that person that's sort of like based on what their work is. So the first one was who's the guy who's into like, who did Pineapple Express? Was that Seth Rogen?
Seth Rogen.
He did like a fine tray for weed for Seth Rogen and just did a whole video on that. And then the next one, he did like this really beautiful toolbox for some other Ari Neistat. Is that Casey's brother? One of the Neistats.
Van Neistat.
Van Neistat. Yeah, he did a really nice toolbox for him. And it's just such a cool idea. It's a series of like, this person is unknown for the most part, right? So it's like, hey, here's a creator I respect. I'm going to pay homage to their work with my work, use it to get better at my craft. I think that's a winning combo. And I think, I mean, I don't know if he's enjoyed doing these, but it kind of feels like he stumbled on something there that's like going to be his thing and will help build his network out with all these other YouTubers.
Well, you are the prophet, man. You call them. Yeah, you're like 10 for 10 so far with calling these people out.
We'll see. We'll see. But I also really... I enjoyed the videos. So Slow Woodshop, Ari Itkin, he's killing it. Go check him out if you like woodworking videos. And that's all I got.
Amazing. I loved it. Thanks, Ethan. Thank you, everybody listening. You want to sign up for the weekly newsletter, go to copybloggerpod.com. We appreciate you guys. We'll talk to you next week. See ya.
Later.